Tonight and next Sunday, we continue the annual lecture series by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel of Boston University. This evening we'll hear, In Recent Times, The Shtetl, A Vanishing World, the second of the three lectures in the series. To introduce Professor Wiesel, here is the chairman of the Center for Judaic Studies, Professor Stephen T. Katz.
Welcome. My name is Stephen Katz. I'm the chairman of the Center for Judaic Studies, and I have the privilege of opening tonight because Professor Wiesel kindly agreed to give this talk in conjunction with a major international conference on the shtetl that began yesterday and will go till tomorrow lunchtime. In this connection, before I say something specific about the shtetl, I'd like to thank some people who deserve thanks, and really words are inadequate. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Mike Grossman. Mike, where are you? Stand up. Mike is the man who has kindly organized the Mike and Marilyn Grossman Foundation and has funded this conference and future conferences, and we're deeply in his debt. It's the kind of generosity that makes it possible to run a Jewish studies program that has all of the richness that one would like to have, and we're deeply in his debt. Also, I understand yesterday was your father's yahrzeit, so let this be a zechus for his memory. Secondly, nothing would happen here of the kind that happens if I didn't have three very special people that I always work with: the Chancellor, John Silber, the President, John Wessling, and the Provost, Dennis Berkey. There are not, I venture to say, many universities that have such leadership, and certainly not many programs that have such wonderful, kind support, and I'm, from the bottom of my heart, thankful to them. Thirdly, I thank Ellen Sulkin, who kindly organized the meals for this conference, and Jewish eating is no small matter, so Thirdly, Professor Catherine O'Connor of the Humanities Foundation, who helped out with some funding for foreign visitors. The Jewish Cultural Endowment that helped with some of the funding for the Klezmer concert last night, and you missed a marvelous concert if you weren't there. Also, I'd like to thank the presenters at the conference who've come from Poland, from Israel, from Canada, from all over the United States, who've really done wonderful, wonderful papers and have made a marvelous contribution to a major conference. Closer to home, I'd like to thank Martha Hauptmann, who is Elie Wiesel's assistant. She's really marvelous, and we thank her. And lastly, the deepest gratitude, I first have to say thank you to my wife, who always is my partner in these things, and always says I should have the last word, yes, dear. And to the most important person, really, in my life in connection to this conference is Pagel Zoka. I don't know where Pagel is. She's the assistant in the center. Pagel, where are you? And she's just, I can't tell you how, she's looked after every detail, worked tirelessly for months, got up 2 o'clock in the morning the other night to make up lists because she couldn't sleep. And she's really been a pleasure, absolute pleasure to work with in general, and I thank her enormously for all the effort. Now to the shtetl. Dotted throughout the landscape of Eastern Europe, in Poland, the first home to such communities, the Pale of the Settlement, the strip along the eastern border of Poland and the western border of Russia, Romania and the Baltic states were innumerable small settlements in which Jews lived for centuries. Allowing for all the necessary diversity in analyzing such settlements that varied from region to region, from state to state, and from century to century, it still can be said that Jews came to create a unique and dynamic lifestyle in villages and towns of different sizes known as shtetls, a diminutive term derived from the Yiddish word shtat, or town. As late as the 1930s, 40% of Polish Jews still lived in such villages or townlets. As one Yiddish memoirist reminds us, quote, "The whole world was commonly assumed to be just one shtetl after another." Here, the Jewish people, in all of their economic, social, intellectual, and religious variety, lived out their lives, eked out a meager living as peddlers, tailors, cobblers, blacksmiths, small shopkeepers, dairymen like Tevye, small farmers, and created a vibrant culture, primarily in Yiddish, Hebrew being reserved for purposes of piety and scholarship. Here they educated their offspring in cheder and yeshiva, organized free loan gemilas chesed societies and hachnasas kala societies, societies to provide dowries for the bride who were poor, immersed themselves in the mikveh, the ritual bath, emphasized and practiced the mitzvah, the religious obligation of charity, kept a kosher dietary regimen, were concerned with yichus, family distinction based on lineage. My mother-in-law has still not forgiven me. Were highly conscious of social pressure, had Gentile neighbors who would kindly light their fires on the Sabbath, measured time by traditional Jewish calendars and rounds of religious festivals, prayed faithfully and regularly in their shuls, their cloises, their shtiblach, small Hasidic prayer houses, with the additional spiritual input of special Yiddish prayers, the tchinas, offered by the women of the community, supported by their tears. And they formed, of course, Chevra Kadisha, holy societies as they were known, to look after the last rites of those who had gone to the world above. At the same time, the shtetl was a place of intense internal communal strife, best known through the conflict of the Hasidim and their opponents, the Mitnagdim, and between Jews of different classes. Usually in the Yiddish you'll read about Prusta Yidden, sort of crude, vulgar, simple Jews, and Balabatasha Yidden, fine Jews, educated Jews. This latter conflict exacerbated by the drafting of young men into the Tsar's army, where the rich were able to buy their way out. The shtetl was also a place defined, for the most part, by continually difficult relations with the political authorities and with the non-Jewish neighbors, primarily Catholic peasants, who regularly lived side by side with the Jews in these small communities, and, like Colin Powell, often spoke Yiddish. You know, he comes from New York. He's a Yiddish speaker. I don't know if he talks to Osama bin Laden in Yiddish, but that's... The clearest expression of these strained relationships were first the pogroms that from the time of Khmelnytsky in the mid-17th century undermined all the security of Jewish life, and then finally, ultimately, the vast, immeasurable desolation of the Holocaust. From the mid-19th century on, the shtetl became the locus in fact and imagination of conflict between the traditionalists, that's the Hasidic masters and their disciples and the non-Hasidic traditionalists, and the maskilim, the enlightened Jews, who sought to bring various forms of intellectual and social political modernization and religious reform to the Jewish community. For the traditionalists, the shtetl was an acceptable, though harsh, form of Jewish communal life, regulated, as it was, by age-old custom, rabbinic authority, social hierarchy, the belief in wonders and charismatic leaders, and an ardent faith in the imminent coming of the Messiah, a miraculous event for which the pious arose each evening and prayed. For the maskilim, the enlightened Jews, and their later still more secular and radical heirs, the Bundists, the Zionists, the atheists, the shtetl was a dark social prison, defined by religious obscurantism, medieval superstition, class inequalities, agunot, abandoned wives, and for the Zionists, false hopes that a satisfactory solution to the Judenfrage, the Jewish question, could be found in galut, the exile, the traditional term full of emotion, used for life, lived outside the land of Israel. Tonight, as part of the intensive consideration of shtetl life and history being undertaken in our conference on the shtetl, we acknowledge not only the scholarly obligation to collect and sort material, to evaluate sources and motives, to seek explanations for actions taken over the centuries, but also the obligation to remember. To remember literally millions of Jews who, each in their own way, sought to live a life of dignity despite the hardships and subjugation, who sought to find and follow the light of truth, whether this took them to the Rebbe's Tisch, the Wonder Workers' dinner table, or to the Polish and Russian gymnasium, who sought to provide a home full of love and care for their large families, despite the ever-shrinking economic pie that eventually led millions, thankfully, to emigrate to America and elsewhere in the West, and who attempted to foster a living Jewish community that did, if imperfectly, concern itself with the widow, the orphan, and the poor. And we recall their end. Millions of men, women, and children who were killed in the ghettos of World War II, killed by the Einsatzgruppen, murdered at Auschwitz, Treblinka, Sobibor, Chełmno, and Majdanek. To help us remember, to guide us back to this lost universe tonight, we are very, very privileged to have an authentic voice that is representative of the best of the vanished world of which we speak, Professor Elie Wiesel. Professor Wiesel, who enthusiastically supported the idea of this conference from the beginning of its planning more than a year ago, is a product of this special past. Deeply educated in Jewish traditional sources, personally knowledgeable in the ways of the Hasidic court, known to Hasidic masters not as Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner, but as Eliezer ben Shlomo, Eliezer, the son of the pious Reb Shlomo, and a survivor of the darkness that fell on this world, on his village of Szeged in 1944, and the living hell that followed at Auschwitz, he is uniquely qualified to conjure up an image of this extraordinary world that was but is no more. Without further ado, I am very honored to present Professor Elie Wiesel.
Thank you very much, Professor Steve Katz. Now, having given the lecture, may I give an introduction to it? I cannot not tell you a story. There was a very, very great preacher called the Dubner Maggid, the preacher of Dubno. And the story is that when he was very young, he needed a pulpit. So he came to a certain community. And he didn't know that they asked another candidate for the same Sabbath. So Thursday night, the preacher of Dubno, in his little hotel room, was preparing a very, very good speech for Saturday. In the next room, there was the other candidate, and he heard the speech. He wrote it down, and he learned it by heart. And so he asked to be the first. And he spoke. It was a very good speech. Then the Dubner Maggid, the Maggid of Dubno, when his turn came, he said, "Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen," or "gentlemen," he said, "look, what can I tell you?" He said, "You know very well that knowledge in the Jewish tradition means good memory. And you must realize, I just heard this man once. I'm going to repeat it word by word." So I will repeat Steve Katz, but in my own words. But first, of course, I want to thank him for organizing the conference. I want to thank, of course, Michael Grossman for doing everything for the conference. And the same people he thanked, of course, I always thank. The chancellor, the president, and all my colleagues and students at this great university. Now, as for the topic, whenever I think of the shtetl, the small, colorful Jewish kingdom so rich in memories, I am filled with pity and sadness. I think of those men and women who created it, nourished it, and kept it alive. I think of the known and the unknown, the sacred and the profane, the impoverished tutors and their mischievous pupils, the joyous innkeepers and their weary customers, the beggars and their songs, as well as the princes in disguise, carriers of ancient melodies and eternally renewed dreams of hope and redemption. How did they manage, for such a lengthy period in history, to overcome so many threats and perils from a world that could not understand them? In my mind, I see them again, defenseless citizens living on love and faith in the streets of the shtetl somewhere in Poland, Romania, White Russia, Hungary, Ukraine, in short, in all the regions of Oriental and Central Europe, where history's turbulent winds brought them, often by force, as if to plant there a variety of aspirations and regrets without which no culture could ever flourish. Since when has the shtetl existed, at least under this name? Whose idea was it? Who was its first builder? Heaven knows. History does not. In those times of ancient calendars, kings and rulers, who could no longer dwell in boredom, found both pleasure and interest in chasing their Jews from one province to another, from one country to another, only to invite them back so as to help rebuild their national economy and at the same time divert the anger of the population towards them. I hope you will not mind my dealing with this theme from neither the sociological nor the anthropological viewpoints, which I'm sure you will hear lectures, have already heard lectures on the topic here, and you will tomorrow. Rather than deliver a lecture, my goal is to indulge in an evocation of and a meditation on memory. The reason is simple. Though buried in the ashes of recent history, the shtetl remains very much alive to some of us whose numbers constantly decrease. Oh yes, we are the last remnant of these Jewish communities that the cruelties of the 20th century have destroyed forever, but whose traces can still be found in some memories and words, strangely dispersed, as if determined to go on haunting a world that wants to forget. Like most survivors, I live in fear. What will happen when the last witness is no longer here to testify or simply to tell the tale? Who will he or she be? What will become his or her burning images, tears and whispers and prayers? What will it mean when there is no longer anyone who can say, the shtetl? You want to know what it was like living and dying there? Listen, I come from... What makes a place inhabited by Jews a shtetl? Literally, the word means, as you heard from Professor Katz, a small city or a small town. So it may be accurate to call a city of 10 or 15,000 Jews a shtetl. But what about a locality of only 2,000? Or a village numbering no more than 122? How is a shtetl to be measured? By what characteristics is it recognized? Only by its picturesque or exotic aspects? Why is Chagall's Vitebsk a shtetl, whereas Saloniki with its exiled Jews, proud Jews from Spain and Portugal, is not? The fact is that the shtetl belongs to the Ashkenazi world of Eastern Europe. But what about its beginnings? Again, no precise date seems to be available. All we know is that a Jewish presence in Western Europe can be traced back to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, who brought back many of its Jews to Italy, France, and Germany. As for Eastern Europe, chronicles tell of Jews during the persecutions linked to the First Crusade in 1096, fleeing Prague for Krakow. Since then, Jews came and left and returned again to Poland, where they knew periods of relative happiness and distress. In 1261, King Boleslav the Pious published his Statute of Kalisz, guaranteeing Jews many important rights. Example, it prohibited Christians from falsely accusing Jews of blood libel. The king went so far as to threaten transgressors with the same punishment Jews would have received had the accusations been founded. The blood libel, as some of you may remember, was what? Some Christians would accuse some Jews of killing children and use their blood for the Passover matzah. And the whole thing, everybody knew from the Pope down that it was wrong. And often the popes themselves intervened to say that is not true. Another Polish king known for his kindness towards Jews was Casimir the Great, who reigned in the mid-14th century. Some people think he protected the Jews because he had a Jewish mistress. Her name was Esterke. Esterke, like Esther in the Megillah, just like her namesake, and therefore, apparently, whether she was real or not, but she surely had a strong positive influence on the king, who was real. In general, the living conditions of Jews depended on the mood and character of the kings, and also the economic situation in the land. In other words, Jews never knew what tomorrow would bring. They endured many pogroms, some worse than others, bloodier than others. Take the massacres conducted by the bloodthirsty mobs under Hetman Bogdan Chmelnytsky in 1648, when most Jewish communities were decimated. At least 70 to 80,000 Jews were murdered. In the chronicles of the time, one reads scenes of such brutality that in Scholemarsch's words, one's faith in humanity could be lost. They also contain halachic elements, legal elements that reveal historical events. For example, in a shtetl ravaged by a tempest of fire and blood, the few survivors confronted a heartbreaking dilemma. What should the orphaned community rebuild first, the house of prayer or the cemetery? That was the fate of hundreds of communities. The enemy would suddenly emerge with sword in hand, and in a frenzy of hatred, he would behead men, women, and children in the streets, in poorly barricaded homes, caves, and attics. The very great writer, Isaac Babel, who in his Red Cavalry and other short stories described as a lieutenant in the Red Cavalry under Budgeni, he described what they found in those shtetlach. And he said, as an eyewitness, he said he found a terrible, uncanny shtetl. Jews stand at the doors like corpses. I wonder about them. What more are you going to have to go through? In the wake of a bloody Polish pogrom in the town of Komarov, Babel observes his own army, quote, going around indifferently, looting where they can, ripping the clothes off the butchered people. In the martyrology books that we mentioned, when you read those images, you stop reading. They describe how the pogromchiks would open the womb of a woman and put a cat in it and sew it back. It sounds, there are worse. The murderers who would come to these villages and destroy them would leave only when they saw that the last Jew was dead. Then, as if out of nowhere, a man, woman, or an adolescent appeared, haggard in mourning, he or she would try to find his or her way amid the ruins. Then they began digging graves. They buried the dead, said Kaddish, and life once again began flowing, binding the abandoned survivors into a community. They rebuilt their homes, opened schools, arranged weddings and circumcisions, celebrated holidays, fasted on Tisha B'Av, the day we remember the destruction of a temple, and on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, danced on Simchat Torah, and made their children study Talmud. All that while awaiting the next catastrophe. That was life in the shtetl. Parenthesis. While the calm lasted, and even during the storm, great books were written, important lessons offered. At one point, the Vaad Arba HaRatzot, the so-called Committee of the Four Lands, was established. As the highest authority dealt with urgent issues in organized Jewish life that were not covered by tradition of ancient law, its so-called Heter Iska, for instance, authorizing Jewish bankers to ask for interest on loans on certain conditions, which is forbidden in the Bible, and that document is still displayed in every bank in Israel. Then, in the middle of the last century, the brackets of respite and renewal irrevocably closed because our fiercest and bloodiest enemy wanted them to remain so. Of all of Hitler's pledges to his bewitched nation, the only one he almost fulfilled was the one concerning his plan to annihilate the Jewish people and erase it from the surface of the earth. I say almost, for thanks to the Allied armies led by America and their bravery, he lost the war. But when we evoke the shtetl, we must omit the almost. Tragically, there, Hitler's victory seems total. The shtetl is gone. Forever. Granted, Jewish life can be found elsewhere in Europe, in the United States, in the former Soviet Union, and especially in Israel, and surely in Brooklyn. It welcomes us with a face shining with hope. Yes, schools are open, synagogues are functioning, studies are organized, and Jewish life exists. Some people say more Jews study today Talmud than ever in history. There is no doubt that Jewish life is vibrant in America and surely in Boston and surely in this university. One thing is lost. Shtetl. We still have rabbis. We still have teachers. We still have beggars. We still have all the people that were there. Shtetl we don't have anymore. And that is gone. It is gone for good, and it belongs now to the past. Need I say that I miss it, of course? Must I say aloud what in many of my writings I repeat in whispers? The shtetl is my childhood. I remain attached to it. I am faithful to it. Let us try tonight to revisit it together. No matter where it is located on the map, the shtetl has few geographical frontiers. Swallowed by Carpathian mountains or rivers, dominated by Polish princes or governed by Romanian landowners, it is built on the same social structures, contains the same impulses and resources, the same attachment to a collective destiny, both dark and glorious. In other words, in its broad outlines, the shtetl is one and the same everywhere. And Yitzchak Leibowitz Peretz, one of the great, great Yiddish writers, in his Hasidic tales, as well in Singer's novels, the same characters are plagued by the same worries, stifle the same cries, and the same prayers composed in ecstasy. No need to question them. Young and old, rich and poor, satisfied and dissatisfied, what they have in common is their Jewishness. When asked to identify themselves, a Jew in Hungary, Poland, or Romania will not say, I am a Hungarian, Romanian, or Pole of Jewish origin or faith, but simply, I am Jewish. How did they create a Jewish life apart, a separate Jewish identity? Was it the essential part of their heritage, of their collective consciousness, perhaps? Clearly, their Jewishness was at the heart of their commitment to religion and history. Whenever a son or daughter would leave home for study or work in the great city or abroad, the parents' blessing would always be accompanied by the plea, "Do not forget that you are Jewish." For them, being Jewish also had an ethical imperative. It meant that there are things a Jew cannot, must not do. Spast nicht was a common Jewish expression from the shtetl. It's not nice. Not nice for a Jew to say or do certain things in certain ways, which are offensive. And then, too, whatever a Jew did implicated other Jews. That explains the need of Jews not to bring shame on their fellow Jews, not to endanger them. That was a frequent argument governing Jewish behavior in the shtetl. A Jew from the shtetl thinks of other Jews even after leaving the shtetl, even when the shtetl ceased to exist. In the shtetl, the Jew felt that the entire world was looking upon him or her and passing judgment on their actions. And indeed, for the anti-Semite, every Jew is responsible for all Jews, even today. That is why solidarity is a defining theme today as it was in the shtetl. When accusing a single Jew of cheating, the anti-Semite indicts all Jews. When accusing a Jew of being disloyal, the anti-Semite shouts, "All Jews are traitors." Needless to say, all these accusations were baseless fabrications of poisoned minds and tongues. I say this almost in parentheses as well, because I heard that here in Boston, which after all is a cultural city, it is the Athens of the world, there is no city in the world that has many colleges and universities. It has more institutions of higher learning than many countries have. And I hear from the papers what I heard is that the church, Catholic, both Catholic and some Protestants, have openly accused Israel, I don't even know what. And I think it's the wrong time. This is not a time to light another fire. There is enough fire there. This is not a time to come and pass judgment on Israel, after all, an ancient people in a modern land which has problems that America now is learning what problems mean. Israel lives the danger of terror day after day. And of all times, today, we should have more understanding and more compassion, more lucidity and almost more intellectual honesty. Does it mean that the shtetl was, in my mind, as I describe it often, a kind of anti-Sodom, a city of no evil? Everybody was good. Does this mean that all its inhabitants were saints? Of course not. Since 1516, we have known that utopia is a place that does not exist. The absolute is a divine attribute, not a human one. As everywhere else, among the inhabitants of the shtetl, good and wretched men could be found, even belonging to the same synagogue. Some were pure, others were not. Some were innocent, others guilty. But in the shtetl, people had no illusions about each other's shortcomings. Speaking of Yankel, in my town, they would say, "What? Are you me, Yankel the thief?" Or Urke the liar. They all knew he was a liar and the other one was a thief. So what? That's life. There was even an informer in my town. I remember him. That must have been his profession. He had red hair and wore brown leather boots. Whenever he would appear in shul, people would lower their voices. He didn't mind. He knew that we knew. Somehow he wasn't ostracized. Not a single person was hurt because of him. Maybe that was his profession, his livelihood. He was cheating the police, not us. And also, maybe it was because the overwhelming majority of Jews in my town were Hasidim, and Hasidism teaches compassion, even for the sinner. Hasidism. Let us seize the opportunity to elaborate on this movement, which grew to become the spiritual symbol of the shtetl for nearly two centuries. It can be said that Hasidism was born in the shtetl and could not have been born anywhere else, not in Paris, and surely not in New York. It is an isolated and impoverished villages and hamlets that Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name, known as the Besht, gathered his first friends, allies, disciples, and followers. It is said that he personally visited more than 280 of them, always on a horse and wagon. He was attracting by his mere presence simple men and women in need of strength, as well as scholars in search of transcendence. In big cities, people were too busy and perhaps too tired to go and hear a wandering preacher, a teller of tales, who came not to reprimand, but to reassure. The best in the beginning took children to school, addressed women in marketplaces, neglecting no occasion to create and broaden his network of solidarity and companionship, and thus save thousands of families and hundreds of small communities from despair and oblivion. One must remember, for the Jewish villagers and inhabitants of small, forsaken communities, exile had become unbearable. Resignation would have made the separation irrevocable, had it not been for the Besht, especially in those times. It was 20 years that the Khmelnytsky pogrom brought the Shabtai Tzvi, after the pogrom, Shabtai Tzvi, one of the greatest disasters in modern history then, the false Messiah. So Jews lost on both grounds. They lost physically and spiritually. Those were the times when the communities were split, when the families were split. And therefore they needed now a new voice. It is in the shtetl that Hasidism flourished. Elsewhere in the big cities, the establishment exerted its powerful influence in matters of economy and economic welfare and intellectual development to such a degree that it gave villagers the feeling of being pushed away, despised. For them, for their survival, the Hasidic message was essential, even vital. What was its content? That God listens even to those men and women who do not know the mysteries of Kabbalah. That God is present everywhere, in all our endeavors, in all our aspirations. Not only in study, but also in prayer. Both lead to God. One may attain truth by way of the heart as well as the mind. The illiterate shepherd with a warm heart is for God as important as the learned man whose knowledge is rooted in books. A Rabbi Moshe Leib Sassover, a Rabbi Zusya of Onipol, and Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev could not have emerged in Troyes, France, Odessa, or Vilna, where biblical study and Talmudic research involved a dazzling elite, itself dazzled by inspired teachers endowed with charismatic powers. Their Hasidic masters were not needed. They were needed in the small villages, in the shtetl where tired and sad Jews had to be told that the Talmudic scholar accomplishes in 1,000 pages of commentary. But a devout Hasid can do the same, obtain the same by reciting with fervor one prayer alone, the simplest of all, Shema Israel, hear, O Israel, God is one. What mattered was the kavanah, the purity of intent, the spiritual commitment. A story, a beautiful one. One day the Besht summoned his close disciples and told them that it was time to do the necessary thing so as to hate redemption. One must not wait any longer. They had better be ready to knock at the highest and most secret gates, all inaccessible to the common mortal, break the lock and allow the Messiah to appear and save those who needed him. The Besht knew what had to be done. He knew the place, the time, and the words. Thus his disciples received from him precise instructions for the days and nights ahead. They would meet on the first day of the first week of the month of Elul, somewhere in the forest. Burning with enthusiasm and mastering their impatience, the best disciple followed his instructions to the letter. They fasted from Sunday to Friday, prayed with particular kavanah, recited at midnight the litanies known only to the initiated, spent hours concentrating on certain combinations of divine names, ever careful not to allow any impure thoughts to enter theirs, invoked memories of ancestors until the day arrived. From near and far, they converged upon the secret place in the forest. But the Besht wasn't there. Precious moments turned into anguished hours. Silently, not daring to look at one another, the disciples wondered whether they had done something wrong. were they unworthy of their sacred task? Perhaps they misunderstood or misinterpreted some of the master's directions. Were they responsible for the failure of the entire undertaking, which had cosmic implications? They were close to despair when the Rebbe appeared breathless. "Don't feel guilty," he told them. "You haven't done anything wrong. This morning, as I left the village on my way to be here with you, I heard a child crying in a house nearby. I opened the door. The room was empty. I looked to my right, to my left. Nobody, only the child in his cradle. He was weeping. His mother must have gone to do an errand. His tears broke my heart. So I stayed a while to calm him. I sang for him. When I stopped, he cried again. So I went on singing. Oh, I knew, with all my heart and soul, I knew that you were waiting for me and that the Messiah himself was waiting. But what could I do? I thought when a Jewish child cries, one must not leave him. When the lowly Jewish child is so unhappy that he is crying, the Messiah will have to wait." Another tale. It happened on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the new year, before or during the Musaf service. The hour was near for the Mendel, the appointed man, to blow the shofar, which would permit the holy community of Israel to plead before the celestial tribunal for a good year, for themselves, for the whole world. Reb Mendel was waiting for Rabbi Moshe Leib Sassover's order. But the Rebbe was preoccupied because Satan in heaven had erected obstacles to interfere with the prayers. So he used all his inner resources and appealed to his ancestors, imploring them to help him vanquish Satan. In vain. Satan remained vigorous and his barricade unmovable. The Rebbe increased his effort, reciting prayers used for emergencies only, still nothing. As for the faithful, they felt the gravity of the situation. They were about to burst into tears. But all of a sudden, the delicate sound of a flute pierced the silence. It was a young shepherd who played. Naturally, after the shock subsided, he was reprimanded by the faithful. Didn't he know that it is forbidden to play musical instruments on such a holy day, on Rosh Hashanah? But the Rebbe quieted them down. "Why did you want to play?" he asked the young man. "I don't know how to pray," answered the young shepherd. "I don't even know how to read. But like everybody here, I wanted to do something. To do something for God and tell him that I love him. That's why I played a tune for him." Then the Rebbe, his sadness gone, spoke to his disciples of his joy. "What I couldn't achieve with my prayers, this young shepherd did with his tune. He vanquished Satan. And now let us proceed with the sacred service. Reb Mendel, blow the shofar, Reb Mendel." Adversaries of Hasidism, as you heard from my friend Professor Katz, denigrate such tales, describing them as anti-intellectual, unworthy of the Jewish tradition, which emphasizes learning. That was, by the way, the major complaint leveled at the Bastion movement. Too much prayer, not enough study. It encourages complacency and ignorance. Unfair, say the supporters of Hasidism. All of the Besht's closest disciples and friends, the Maggid of Meserich, the Pilchas Lekoretzer, among others, they all had high standing in the scholarly community, but they felt the need then to think of the poor people as well, of the ignorant people as well. Because in truth, the Besht had one goal: to sustain the Jew by showing that his or her links to the great community of Israel are indestructible. As Rabbi Aaron of Karlin, who actually came to convert the Misnagdim to Hasidism, he used to say, "If you don't know the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, study Talmud. You don't know the Talmud, open the Bible. You don't know the Bible, say Psalms. You don't know Psalms? Shema Israel, you know. No? Then just think of your people, of our people, and love one another. That will be sufficient." You may ask, is that really sufficient? Correction. As a beginning, that will be sufficient. After all, to love one's fellow man is a biblical commandment. That would lead the Hasid to look for it in the text and study its commentaries and climb the ladder of knowledge higher and higher. What was important was not to give up. In the shtetl, one often had reason to doubt and despair. But then the Besht came and declared, stop, take hold of yourselves. The people of Israel needs each and every one of you, and so does he, the God of Israel. A Hasidic master would never say to his disciple, you study too much, you spend too much time buried in books. Quite the contrary. He would say to him, you have not studied enough yet, continue, learn more, always more, but remember, study alone is not enough, because it must bring you closer to other human beings, your friends, your neighbors. That is why, until the very last day of the shtetl, Hasidic shtiblech existed in every small city, in every village, even in places where there was no local rabbi or local rabbi. In my little town, there were Hasidim belonging to many rabbis who would on occasion come to spend a few days and evenings with them, and then the entire town would join. They would join them for services or a tish on Shabbat. To be together, that was what Hasidim wanted, to be able to evoke common experiences and events one or the other has witnessed at the court of his or her master. The book Haverim, the obligation to be attached to friends, was and still is to Hasidim as important a principle as Emunat Tzedikim, faith in the just teacher. At this point, let's be frank. When we speak of the shtetl and his Hasidism and the Hasidim's boundless faith in the tzaddik, we must not fail to recall that it also had those who believed in the occult. People believed not only in the intercession of rabbis, but also in the evil activities of Satan's envoys. They were feared for their malevolent tricks and deeds. They were supposed to curse certain homes, turn friends into enemies, steal newborns. I remember these stories from home. People also believed in virgins being possessed by dead souls or the books that very few rabbis could exorcise. There is a beautiful film on that, which I urge you to go and see, the Dibuk. It's in Yiddish. All those legends on the powers of King Ashmedai's wife, Lilith, and on the little devils lurking in the woods on nocturnal voyages, and on the dead who rise from their graves at midnight, go to the synagogue and read from scripture. Woe to the passerby who, if summoned by them, does not enter going backwards, not to see them. I myself remember how I used to tremble when I had to use the sidewalks near the cemetery. Though terrified, we did not let anything interfere with our studies. A shtetl without schools or a cheder yeshiva was inconceivable. The poorest of the poor saved enough or nearly enough to pay for his children. Tutor. Education began at age 3, when the father would envelop a child in his talit and bring him to cheder. For the little boy, the cheder did not represent a kindergarten where he could play with his peers, but the first alien, probably hostile environment, far from his parents. There he would face a teacher with a long beard and at times a nasty look in his eye. If a pupil resisted repeating him, after him, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Aleph, Beis, Gimel. Usually, in spite of the honey candy given to him for every letter as a promise of the Torah's sweetness, the little boy would begin to cry. He would worry that once he was through with the Aleph Beis, he would have to open the 5 books of Moses, then Rashi's commentaries, and then the Talmud, and multitudes of commentaries on commentaries. In other words, he would fear that there would be no end to study. Well, little boy from the shtetl, that's how it is. That's how it has always been. Ask your fathers and grandfathers, ask 30 centuries of fathers, and they will tell you, the study of Torah has a beginning but no end. The passion for learning, which is an essential part of the Jewish tradition, did not begin in the shtetl, but it existed there, it flourished there. I never saw my father or any of my uncles go anywhere without a book under their arms. What was the worst insult hurled at a person? That he's an amaretz, an ignoramus, who is respected, a Talmid Chacham, a scholar. To describe him, we make use of several words, Ben Torah, son or man of Torah, Ilui, someone with an oceanic memory, Harif, someone with a penetrating intelligence, and of course, Gaon, a genius. Interesting, Louis Finkelstein's Tzar used to say, we Jews have no aristocracy. Our aristocrat is the scholar. That is our aristocrat. And therefore here, of course, again, we must acknowledge reality. Not all children aspire to dedicate their lives to study. Some became merchants, others shoemakers, tailors, woodcutters, barbers, or beggars. There were those who, fed up with the difficulties at home or anti-Semitic provocations in the street, responded to the call of an easier life in the Western world. Some went to study medicine in France or to work with an uncle in America. Why France? Because in our places there was numerous clauses. Jews couldn't get into medical school. A few doctors came back and stayed in my town until the end. Then there were those youngsters who, influenced by communist agitators, ran away to Russia or stayed home to work clandestinely for the communist revolution aimed at transforming society by destroying its structures. At that time, few people were aware of Stalin's cruelty and innate anti-Semitism. Communism was fashionable among many yeshiva bocharim. I used to call it, what is communism? It's messianism without God. How many future communist leaders actually came from the world of the shtetl, and even from the world of the yeshiva? At the origin of their political commitment was the misery of their communities, the despair of people. Was their communism a form of rebellion against their parents? Possibly. But it may also have been intended to spare them further anguish, suffering, and humiliation. And this point must always be remembered. Though we love to celebrate life in the shtetl, from the economical viewpoint, it was far from easy. The shtetl was poor. I remember my first return to my little town 20 years after I had left it. I remember the shock I felt upon discovering how poor the Jews of my town had been. I walked around familiar streets and squares, entering homes of friends I remembered from my childhood. What transformed them into wretched dwellings? Oh, I knew that there were poor people in our midst, but not that there were so many. Nor did I know that even those who were considered wealthy were in fact poor. For instance, my own family. In my childish view, I never thought we were poor. Well, we were not. We owned our own house. We had a store. On Wednesday, beggars would be fed in the courtyard. True, we had no running water. No bathroom, no toilet, so what? One could live very well without such things. Anyway, we were properly dressed, so why complain? It was only two or three generations later that I understood how mistaken I had been. Certain images resurfaced. My parents on a long winter night discussing whether they could afford to buy new clothes for the children. A new stove and our old one broke down. Plan a trip to the mountains. As in everything in life, wealth in the shtetl was relative. Only the poverty of the poor was not. And yet, on Shabbat, if poverty did not vanish altogether, it was diminished, transformed. One can never speak enough about what Shabbat was like in the shtetl and what it did for its inhabitants. Shabbat helped people endure the other 6 days of the week. Days that were often gray and dark and heavy with sorrow and anxiety. Hence the anticipation of Shabbat, which actually began much earlier, Thursday evening or early Friday morning. The housewife would already be busy preparing the challah, gefilte fish and cholent, the traditional elements of Shabbat meal and the shtetl, the white tablecloth, the white shirt. Everything had to be ready and pure. And all that belonged to the housewife's domain. But it too easily forgets what we owe to the wife, to the woman. We owe them the Shabbat. The gift of Shabbat was their gift. Today, Shabbat is not the same. Not even in Israel, not even in Jerusalem. It's not the same. The same Shabbat that was in the shtetl, because Jerusalem is Jerusalem. But the Shabbat in the shtetl was a spark of Jerusalem in exile. With the approach of Shabbat, business was conducted in haste. Shopkeepers and their customers were equally in a hurry to go home. Men would go to the ritual bath, the mikvah, get dressed, get ready, and worthy of welcoming the Shabbat HaMalkah, the queen of the Sabbath. The first to spot Sabbath would be the beadle, the shamus. He would go from store to store and from home to home, shouting, Yidden, great sich to Shabbos. Jews, get ready for Shabbat. Yidden, spalt Shabbos oi de welt. Jews, it's almost Sabbath on the whole world. At home, one did not need these reminders because the mother mind to read the candles honoring Shabbat. One for each member of the family and blessed them silently with gestures of grace and tenderness. And suddenly her face would be illuminated by a light coming from another world, from another time. A light at once frail and eternal, and her beauty multiplied sevenfold, so much so that even now, as I write these words and I say these words, I remember the tears that welled up in my throat. In the shul also, everything seemed different, more luminous, the candelabras, more serene, the faces, more melodious, the prayers. The Talmud is right. On Sabbath, on Shabbat, one gains an additional soul with the Shama Yetera. Then at the end of the service, worshippers would rush towards the visitors from our shul. If there were none, the Shabbos would shout, are there strangers here? It was forbidden to allow anyone to be alone for the Sabbath meal. Often people would fight over a visitor. It was an honor to invite him or her to their table. I myself can hardly remember the Shabbat without an honored guest in our home. And whenever my maternal grandfather, Abdolya, was with us, we felt doubly honored. And I have sworn never to forget him. I remember his return from the Shabbat Eve office when he was with us. He would stop at the threshold, kiss the mezuzah, his face burning with delight, and start the vision at Sernigon, Sholem Aleichem, Sholem Aleichem, Alacha Yashores, be blessed angels in the service of peace. And it was as if peace had now reigned over heaven and earth, a peace that brought together men and women of all nations, of all ages, a dream in which Shabbat remains the inspiring symbol. The end of Shabbat was marked by my mother and grandmother shortly before the Havdalah ceremony, which separates light from darkness and the sacredness of Shabbat from the rest of the week. Both women, all mothers, would recite a special prayer attributed to the great Levi Yitzchok Apratichev, God von Avraham, von Yitzchok, and von Yaakov, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, extend your protection over thy children and ours. And when the prayer ends, the Havdalah begins. If I didn't have now it called, I would sing you this song. Whereupon another song takes hold of my memory. Bobashi, Zognochnit, God von Avraham, a child pleased with his grandmother. Bobashi, don't say this prayer which separates Sabbath from the weekdays. Not yet. Please. Wait a bit longer, he says. The sun hasn't set yet in the west. Let Shabbat last a while longer. And the song ends by saying, and then two tears fall on the face of the grandmother, and the Shabbat is over. Which reminds me of an old Hasid, an old Rebbe, who during the mystical third meal, in his way, did what the grandmother was implored to do in hers. He sings a song. Wenn ich wohl gehad käme, if I had strength, wollte ich in die Gassen gelaufen, I would run through the streets, und ich wohl geschrien her, und I would yell with all my mind, Shabbos, heiliger Shabbos, Sabbath, holy Sabbath. And legend has it that as long as he sang, the Sabbath remained with him and his followers. So he sang and he sang. Yiddish was, of course, a language of the shtetl, a language that dates back to the high Middle Ages. So much so we are told that Goethe studied Yiddish because he wanted to understand the 14th century German. Feverish, rich in meaning and fantasy, it carries better than any other tongue the life and dreams of the shtetl. There are Yiddish words that have no equivalent in any other language. Cholt is something else than a hot plate. Yarmulke is something else than a kippah. Yosem is something else than an orphan. Rachmones is not Rachmanut or compassion. And by the way, did you know what the word cholt really means? It came from Napoleon's times. It ended up when the soldiers were in Russia. It means show long. It put it on a slow burner. Similarly, the name Bele in Yiddish comes from the word Bella. And Yente, which you think is not a nice name, it's a nice name, it comes from the word Gentia. But one thing we don't know, where does the word davening come from? To daven, we don't know where it comes from, to daven. We know what it means, to pray. Oh, I love Yiddish. I love speaking Yiddish. There are songs and lullabies that can be sung only in Yiddish, prayers that only Yiddish grandmothers can whisper at dusk, stories whose charm and secret, sadness and nostalgia can be conveyed in Yiddish alone. Though I imagine Sephardi Jews could offer Ladino the same praise. I love Yiddish because it has been with me from the cradle. I remembered my mother's lullaby, Unten kin zwigere, schlofta weiß, zigere, das zigere ist geforen, handen, roschinkes und mantlen. It was in Yiddish that I spoke my first words and expressed my first fears. It was in Yiddish that I greeted the Sabbath. I didn't say Shabbat Shalom then, but a good Shabbos. This immense love for Shabbat in the shtetl has often inspired Yiddish literature and some anecdotes. But then anecdotes because also we must remember Yiddish has a tremendous sense of humor, shtetl humor. You may ask, isn't humor everywhere the same? No. In the shtetl was a different humor. It was sharper, funnier, yet never offensive. It illustrated the taste for self-ridicule. One laughed at oneself more than at others. Listen, for instance, the brief exchange by Sholem Aleichem. And some people in America, even some journalists or writers, think that it's a name. Sholem is the first name and Aleichem the second name. And they don't know that Sholem Aleichem is a nickname, actually. Anyway. So, listen, for instance. The father says to his son, Moshe le binais, close the window, it's cold outside. And Moshe le answers, Papa, if I close the window, will it be warm outside? A Hasidic anecdote. A future rabbi is received by an illustrious master who asks him, I hear that you are a great scholar, that you know the entire Talmud by heart. Is it true? No, it's not. What? You are telling me that people say it's not true? Not really. I don't know the entire Talmud. I only know half of it. Half? Which half? Any half, says the visitor. A peasant visits the big city and witnesses a grandiose funeral. The coffin is carried by horse and carriage draped in black. Five cantors sing the appropriate chants. A crowd of hundreds accompanies the deceased to his resting place. Who is he? Asks the peasant. Someone tells him, it's a very wealthy man who served as president of the community. Ah, exclaims the peasant, das heißt gelebt, that's called living. And another story. A cantor came home from his Sabbath luncheon, looking depressed. What is the matter, his wife asked. Can you imagine, said the cantor, after all my work on today's service, as we left the synagogue, Yankel, the shoemaker, the cobbler said to me, well, Chazan Cantor, today you were not, you could have been better. How can I be not upset, says the cantor. And the wife says, what does Yankel know about cantorial music? What everybody says, he repeats. And still, a shtetl story that I still remember from home, it's called Eins von die Beide. An unhappy man tells his friend his troubles, more precisely his son's troubles. He has been drafted to serve in the Tsar's army, which is anti-Semitic, as everybody knows. I'm at a loss. What should I do, says the man. Don't worry, says his friend. Eins von den beiden is either or. Either he passes the physical exam or he doesn't. If he fails, why worry? If he passes, eins von den beiden, either or. Either he's sent to the front or he isn't. If he isn't, then everything is okay. What are you worried? But if he does go to the front, eins von den beiden, either he's wounded or he isn't. If he isn't, why be upset? But if he is wounded, then if he's not wounded, either he lives or he dies. If he lives, oh, he's perfect, why worry? If he dies, again, eins von den beiden, either he goes to paradise or to hell. If he goes to paradise, it's okay. But if he goes to hell, eins von den beiden. Either he manages to bribe the guard or... Don't worry, he'll do. Well, naturally, laughter in the shtetl is a remedy for misfortune, fear, and despair. In a way, it's the best reflection of the Shtetl's generosity of spirit. In spite of the religious dissension, as you heard from my friend Steve Katz, political splits and social conflicts that can be found in every community, the Shtetl's spirit of generosity cannot help but move the reader. Numerous groups, committees, and associations existed to cover well-defined sectors, the poor, the aged, the sick, the prisoners, the widows and orphans, the dead. Even the rich who were no longer rich, they were taken care by a secret committee, Matan Beseta, the clandestine charity, had at its disposal special funds that were slipped under the doors of the recipients at night in order not to embarrass them, so that in case they didn't want people to know that they lost their fortune. Even nobler was the way some communities dealt with tzedakah. Every year before Passover, people would line up at the entrance of the community offices. Inside, in an empty room, there was a table and on it a plate with money. A person would enter the room alone. If he or she was able, they left money. If not, they took money. And no one ever knew how much was taken or given. Another custom which reflects the Shtetl's sensitivity to people's pain and sorrow, which is a beautiful custom. At funerals, the beadle would precede or follow the coffin with a black charity box in his hands, chanting, Tzedoke Tatzel Mimoves, meaning charity saves us from death. Question, is it true? If so, wouldn't the rich live 100 years and 20, if not longer? They could give charity every week, every day and hour, and live. But it's not that simple. I heard a superb commentary by a rabbi. What is the meaning of charity? He asked. It is for the living to demonstrate that he or she is concerned with someone else's sickness or woes or problems. One who is not concerned is in fact not sensitive. One who is not sensitive is not really alive. And this is the meaning of the appeal. Charity saves one from dying while one is still alive. In the Shtetl, people lived well or badly, but they lived before dying. They lived in fear, but they lived their fear. And that was so until the day when the cruelest of our enemies reduced the Shtetl to ashes. So may I, in conclusion, now speak of all that remains of the Shtetl, its memory. Long ago I wrote a plea for the dead. Then I composed a plea for the survivors. And now I felt the need to write a new plea, a plea for the right to be remembered. I confess, in spite of my growing pessimism concerning the memory of Auschwitz and Treblinka, I did not anticipate the recent insults and attacks from various quarters that survivors had to endure. Relentless and obscene, they reflect a total absence of sensitivity. It was that it is as if they were to be hated for having suffered, for remembering, and above all, therefore, for surviving. Their desire to bear witness is being questioned, as is the truth of their testimony. Unworthy motives are being attributed to them. Their suffering is being transformed into farce and entertainment in films, plays, docudramas, and musicals. At best, they are being used for pseudoscientific tests, so to prove 1001 scholarly theories, and they, the survivors, are not allowed even to object. My friend and companion, Primo Levi, called these malevolent critics and commentators, I quote him, thieves of time, who insinuate themselves through keyholes and cracks and steal our memories without leaving a trace, unquote. Was it better in the beginning when there were no such thieves, when few writers dared to approach the theme itself? The survivors themselves preferred to be mute since no one was willing to hear their tales, which they considered morbid. Good-hearted people would interrupt them, giving them soothing counsel. The past is past. Forget it. Better look to the future. Anyway, survivors forced themselves or were forced into silence, thinking, what's the use? What we have to say, nobody would understand anyway. Was Carlyle right in claiming that language belongs to time and silence to eternity? Must the ineffable remain outside the realm of words simply because there are no words? Can Auschwitz be understood by anyone who wasn't there? An Israeli historian claims to be able to easily explain everything, and in doing so proves how far he is from understanding. Between facts and truth, there is an abyss one may not cross with impunity. Only those who were there know what it meant being there. And yet, at one point, we all felt compelled to listen to Shimon Dubnov's last desperate plea as he was led to his execution by a Gestapo chief who was his former pupil, Yin, schreibt und verschreibt. Jews, write down everything. So we decided to open up our memory and within the framework of what is possible to do the impossible. Is it because of the Holocaust deniers who now dominate so many websites with their repulsive stories and articles? No. They don't deserve such credit. We must never grant them the dignity of a debate. But lately the attacks come from another direction as well, from Jews too. Motivated by a senseless hatred of Israel, they try to legitimize its authority by depriving it of its memory. After all, we all have the same memory. And then they slander those who defend it. One of them went so far as to write a preface to a book by the principal denier in Europe, Faurisson. His disciple and ally published a frivolous pamphlet which became a bestseller in German-speaking countries because of its vicious attacks on Zionists and survivors. He calls them liars, profiteers, manipulators. In Germany, Martin Walser, seen as the old man of letters, dared to declare publicly that he is sick and tired of being reminded of Auschwitz. Ernest Nolte, who acquired notoriety by relativizing the Holocaust, received an important award that provoked shock on both sides of the ocean. In many academic and literary circles, a taboo has been broken. Now everything goes. Nothing is off limits. Novels are extolled. Testimonies downgraded. What used to be sacred is being commercialized, trivialized. Receiving a Tony Award on a television show watched by millions all over the world, a talented comedian apparently did a play which I didn't see. He found it permissible to say, "Thank you, Adolf Hitler," then adding, "for being so funny on stage." Surely to his victims, Hitler was many things, but never funny. What then can the last survivors of the shtetl do to preserve its memory? The task is getting harder and harder, more and more discouraging. We are all aware of that. But to abdicate, to abandon our memory would be worse. It would be treason. And we shall not do that. No matter what, we cannot. We must not and we will not. When the shtetl was alive, was it better? But it isn't. Thank you.
You have just heard the second in a series of three lectures by Professor Elie Wiesel, holder of the Nobel Peace Prize. Join us next week for the third in this annual series entitled In the Talmud, The Orchard, A Dangerous Adventure. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. And join the conversation on our website at wbur.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Chris Bannon. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.